This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Hello and welcome to another episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour. I am not an hour. I'm not either hour. I'm not 60 Minutes and I'm not Dr. Michael Hour, the eponymous superstar of this podcast, affectionately known by me as Der Kaiser. I'm John Bruford, one of your hosts, joined by Dr. Michael Hour, your other host, Der Kaiser. Dr. Hour, how are you?
Very well.
Man, a few words there. But we're joined by somebody who's going to talk a lot more, hopefully. We're joined by, and I'm just going to make sure that I get the titles right. We're joined by Andrew Kim, who is a Canada Research Chair in Addictions and Mental Health Comorbidity and Associate Professor at the Department of Psychology at the Toronto Metropolitan University. Andrew, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Michael.
So is your bread and butter that addictions and mental health comorbidity thing? Because it's something that always comes up, or something that I always bring up in conversations, specifically about gambling addiction, because I think it's something that's not so well understood by the average person when it's reported in the media. Gambling addiction, oh, it's terrible, it's evil. It's very rarely referenced that it is generally, in almost every instance that I'm aware of, it's a symptom of another ill. So is that kind of your bread and butter?
Yes and no. I have several loaves and several butters, as you can say. It's one of my main areas of research, but it's actually my main clinical focus. So I'm a licensed clinical psychologist here in Canada, specifically in the province of Ontario. And most of my clinical training has been working with folks that have a moderate to severe addiction, alcohol, cannabis, gambling, as well as a moderate to severe mental health problem, depression, anxiety, PTSD. And so clinically, that's where my expertise lies. And in terms of my research, trying to better understand why and when and how addictions and mental health often go together is also a key interest of mine. As you mentioned, John, it is not uncommon for individuals who are experiencing an addiction, whether that's alcohol, cannabis, gambling, gaming, to have a co-occurring mental health problem, right? They often go hand in hand. And there are several ways in which addictions and mental health can influence each other. But clinically, what I often see the most is this concept called the self-medication hypothesis. I'm not sure if you've heard about self-medication hypothesis, but it's when people turn to substances, addiction, behavioral addictions like gambling and gaming to help with their mental distress. I always said that addictions are insidious and that it works, right? At least in the short term, alcohol can help us make us forget. Gambling can take us away, right? It's a way that people use to try and cope with the depression, the anxiety, the trauma that they may have. In the short term, it works. In the long term, it's really not the most effective way that you can help manage with your mental health problems.
It's interesting. And You can tell me definitely if I'm barking up the wrong tree here, but cannabis addictions, I was really surprised when you said cannabis is part of that, because, mm-hmm. and maybe this is one of those things where I just don't know anything about it. And it does happen. But as far as I understand, because I used to, you know, take quite a lot of drugs. Or a wide variety of drugs, shall we say. and cannabis was, as it is for most people, one of those. But the way I understand the way that cannabis works is, and I know cannabis addiction is like a recognized thing, but it's not something like with say heroin, where there's a combination of a physiological and a psychological addiction. The, as far as I'm aware, cannabis isn't sort of physiologically addictive, is mm-hmm. it? And so yeah. I would think it's one of those instances where what you're describing, your one of your loaves, is it's probably a really potent one, sort of mental health and cannabis and the self-medication.
Yeah, it's a good question. And there is this notion that cannabis isn't addictive, right? You mentioned this component of the physiological addiction that we have. But I could say, I mean, this podcast is called The Gambling Files. That's the title of it. But would we say gambling has that physiological part as well? No, but it's also widely recognized as an addiction. And
but one of the differences there is surely like, so look at alcohol, heroin, mm-hmm. cannabis, gambling, just mm-hmm. as four things that are addictive. Well, gambling's the odd one out there because you don't imbibe a substance in any yep. way. Of the other three, you do imbibe them. The first two come with profound, difficult physiological cravings. And like, seriously, if I'm wrong, just shout me down.
Withdrawal, tolerance.
All of that. Withdrawal, yes, totally, 100%. Whereas cannabis, I would imagine cannabis probably does come with withdrawal, but is that psychological? Is this the mental health side of this, or am I just wrong?
No, you're not wrong per se, and that's always been one of the perceptions that people have, is that cannabis isn't addictive because it doesn't have much of that physiological effect. But there is definitely a psychological tolerance to it, or dependence that people have to cannabis. And there are withdrawal symptoms, but that are more psychological in nature. So I think in terms of the physiological piece, that's only one component of what is an addiction. There are other things that we conceptualize to be an addiction, things like loss of control, right? Having this, not this dependency, but just being unable to stick to what you think is a healthy amount of smoking cannabis, gambling, or drinking alcohol. There's also this preoccupation, right? You spend a lot of time thinking about it. You have spend a lot of time consuming it, gambling, drinking alcohol, recovering from the effects. There is this negative consequences. I think that's a big one, that addictions do cause harm to not just the individual, but interpersonal relationships, society. So the physiological part is just one component of this overall notion of what an addiction is. And I have worked with a lot of clients and patients that do come with cannabis addiction. And yeah, it's honestly, in terms of how people experience it, an addiction in terms of the loss of control, the negative consequences, the preoccupation, it's no different, I find, than alcohol, opioids, gambling, etc.
That's really interesting. Thank you. Sorry, yes. Michael.
I was thinking before, you mentioned something very interesting. You mentioned the escapism, basically, right? Mm-hmm. Gambling mm-hmm. is actually a treatment of other underlying issues. So the activity is something that diverts a person's attention, you know, away from the actual problems. And I was thinking, you know, lately, and we discussed this multiple times on the podcast, about the actual goal of safer gambling, right? So, I mean, I'm a responsible gaming, safer gambling professional, or that's where I spend most of the time, you know, thinking about, okay, how can you actually create a safer gambling environment, you know? And you have researched with Dr. Michael Wall, limit setting, you know, pop-up messages, etc., etc. And what I see predominantly in regulation today and more is a very strong focus on money spent, right? So the main focus of regulation is actually to prevent people from spending more money or more money than they actually have. But what is this actually the main issue, right? And then I'm asking myself, okay, why do people at the end of the day gamble? And I'm talking about gambling where you can win money, right? Casino, sports betting, etc. Mm-hmm. Do they predominantly engage into that activity because they want to win money, because they believe they can win money, and then it might develop, you know, into a habit, into a preoccupation, into an addiction? Or is it more likely to be actually an escapism? They play the slots just, you know, to avoid thinking about the daily issues. And if I, you know, if it sort of leans towards the second reason, then the RG tools, the responsible gaming tools, the safer gambling tools should actually communicate differently, right? Regulation could work differently because it's about, you know, the person not sort of diverting from their problems, actually supporting them. Hey, I mean, you know, solve your other issues, and then gambling will not develop into an issue.
Yeah, so I think that's
in your clinical experience, what are your clients' main reasons to seek treatment?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And as we know, there's different reasons why people gamble, right? We're talking about motivational aspects of gambling. So some do gamble to win money, right? That's their main driving factor. Some gamble because it's something to do with friends, right? It's exciting, they're celebrating, their social motives. Others, yeah, gambling's exciting. You risk something, $100, you can win 500, you're watching the game, you're watching the roulette wheel spin. That brings up a lot of excitement. For others though, yeah, gambling can be this escapism. So I think you make a really interesting point. And I haven't seen much research looking at effectiveness as responsible gambling tools. Like, we know they're effective. We know most people don't use them. But, you know, I'm always thinking, for whom and when would these tools be effective? And I think one piece of the puzzle that we might be missing is looking at motivational aspects, right? Is there different effects of these tools in terms of their effectiveness and willingness for people to use them based on their underlying reasons of why they're gambling? So I mentioned escapism is one motive. And clinically, in terms of some of the research that I've done as well, one of the things that I find striking is when we ask people, you know, what caused your gambling problems, right? From people with lived experience. And I have a few papers on this. They mentioned that it's coping motives. It's not the only motive. There's others for sure. But there is a significant proportion of people who've developed problems say, gambling is a way for me to escape my trauma.
Yeah.
Right? It kind of helped. Clinically, that's what I see as well. It's not the only pathway between addictions and mental health. Sometimes addictions can lead to mental health problems. Sometimes they're interrelated. Sometimes they're not connected at all. But at least clinically, from what I've seen and some of the research that I've done, one of the common ways that people say that they developed an addiction or the function behind it is that it helped alleviate their distress. So some of the gambling problem would say, you know, I never used to have a gambling problem, but I find it kind of worked. It kind of helped me forget my traumas. It's something that I did when I was really depressed, right? It kind of helped me forget. I think Natasha, Dr. Scholl talked about the slot machine zone, right? That dissociation that they're able to just kind of forget for several hours. And for people, that's really powerful. If you really think about it, if you have something that's going to take away that distress, that mental health difficulty, the trauma, it can be a really powerful tool for someone. And that's some, for some, that's the way they get hooked. And we know that coping motives, so people who say that they gamble as a way to alleviate their distress or to help with mental health problems, we know that has a really high association with problem gambling. Yeah. So I think you're right. Responsible gambling tools, the function of it. And I would say for those that's their main motive to gamble, is that escapism. I'm not sure responsible gambling tools are going to be the best bet. I don't think any addiction is going to be the most helpful or effective way to help with their mental health problem.
Yeah. Mm. And I mean, another good confirmation of that hypothesis are social casinos, because in social casinos, players can't win money. Mm-hmm. They spend actually, you know, relatively small amounts, but play mm-hmm. extended time periods. And that's, you know, a very good confirmation of exactly this, you know, coping motive for gambling. It's not about the money, but for them, it's really about spending time forgetting about, you know, their other underlying issues. That's mm-hmm. why social casinos are, you know, very successful, although they don't ruin players because they spend little money.
Yeah. For most, like, you hear stories about some people spending $36,000, right? Yeah, yeah. Mm. And then there's this whole transitional aspect. And I used to do some research in this area where people that start on social casino games then transition to real money gambling. But I've seen the opposite pathway too. People that gamble then go to social casino games because I said, you know, kind of gives me the same function. And I think for those, it could be boredom, right? Something to do. But yes, maybe sometimes escapism. They don't need to spend $500 on the slots. They can play social casino games and it might do the same thing.
Yeah. And I meant because, I mean, coming back to what John said before about, you know, substance related and non-substance related addiction. Let's say if playing the roulette or casino relaxes you mm-hmm. and cannabis relaxes you, then it ultimately has the same effect, right? It's something, you know, mm-hmm. it relieves your stress, and then the impact, you know, on your emotions is the same, and both can lead to an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because no, absolutely. You're addicted actually to the consequence, to the impact that this activity or this substance has on your mind.
Yeah. So addictions gives you something, right? Whether it's alcohol, whether it's cannabis, whether it's gambling, we're getting something from it. So there's a motivation aspect to it. There's a function to it. And so I think in terms of when I work with clients, that's something I want to understand. What does the addiction do for you?
Yeah. Exactly.
Because if you don't get anything out of it, right? If you don't derive anything out of it, people wouldn't do it.
Exactly.
So what is that function? And the point you make, it's really interesting because there's this concept, and this was the focus of my dissertation, is I looked at this concept called addiction substitution. And clinically, we hear stories about this where, say, I have someone that's working, that I'm working with for gambling addiction. They come, they have a gambling disorder, we're working together, and their gambling disorder goes from, say, severe and to now they're not gambling anymore, right? So they used to gamble every day, spend $200 at the casino, but after 4 or 5 months, they haven't gone to the casino in 3 months, and they have no plans to go to the casino. So, you know, some people might think, oh, they've recovered. But what could happen is that while the gambling is decreasing, they might have started smoking cannabis, using cannabis, right? And now you see the cannabis increasing. And when we look at people who have substituted, so replaced one addiction for another, and we asked them what was their motivation behind it, one of the most common ones that we find was coping. Yeah. It did the same thing for me. I wasn't gambling anymore, but I started to smoke cannabis, and it kind of relaxed me too, helped me forget as well. And over time, that substitute addiction can develop into an addiction itself. Mm. So you just replace one for another.
Yeah. And would you say this is common? That, you know, because it's very interesting what you're saying, you know, because last 2-3 years, I've been reading lots of biographies. Okay, like, you know, mm-hmm. from actors, singers, etc. And many of them had substance-related issues, right? And what you see a clear pattern, once they overcome this, something else develops. So they become, you know, extremely religious. Mm-hmm. Some of them, right? Some of them, you know, extreme into sports, or something is happening, right? But this sort of void, I'd say, which originates from, I don't know, trauma, or is genetic, or whoever, has to be filled somehow. So would you say that there are individuals which simply have this craving for something, whether, you know, this is like extreme gambling, or it's extreme, you know, sports, or extreme risk taking, you know, let's say, I don't mm-hmm. know, shark diving, you know, base jumping, rock climbing, etc. So would you say there is, I mean, in your experience among your clientele, are there, you know, these individuals, do they need something extreme to substitute whatever, you know, sort of physiologically, maybe bad or financially sort of bad that they're doing?
Yeah, so I'll answer your first question of whether this is common. And in terms of some of the research that I've done, it's not common per se. So, you know, when someone gives up one addiction, what could happen is that they give up multiple addictions. They recover from multiple addictions. And we see this as concurrent recovery. And one example, so in terms of the studies that we've done, is we're looking at substitute addictions and concurrent recovery. And someone said that, yeah, I've, you know, when I gave up gambling, my alcohol reduced too. And when we try to ask about, you know, what was the motivation? So how did that occur? How'd you give up one addiction and then another? They said they were functionally tied, so that they would only drink at the casino, or they would drink because they lost a ton of money at the casinos. So that was a way for them to forget. So once they stopped gambling, then there's no function for the alcohol. They didn't need to drink because it was tied together. And so one of the most, so in terms of numbers, what we find in some of the reviews that we've done, only 1/4 of the studies report that people substitute. So it's not the most common. And in terms of my dissertation study, it was really hard to recruit people that have recovered from gambling and substituted. So that kind of tells me that it's not the most common thing that occurs when people recover from an addiction. It's not common that they substitute, but some people do. And I would say, and again, we know this from some of the research that I've done and published on, is when we ask them about this, is because in a lot of the cases, the underlying reason that was driving the gambling wasn't addressed. And I'm going to bring this back to John's first question about my bread and butter. And what we see is that some of that reason is mental health. So they were gambling because it helped with their depression. Now, you address the gambling, but you don't address the depression. What's going to happen? They might find something else that's going to help with the depression, whether it's alcohol, cannabis, gaming, whatever it is. So in terms of my work with clients, is I want to understand what is driving the behavior, right? What is the function of the gambling? Is it to alleviate mental health problems? And if so, as a clinician, I want to address the mental health problems too. Yes, you need to address the gambling as well, but you also need to address the underlying reason and the driving factor behind the gambling.
I want to just chip in here as probably the only addict present, and say, like, that what you're saying, Andrew, about things being linked often in terms of function or performance. 100%. So like when I was 29, I started having a reaction to caffeine because I was just drinking such ludicrous amounts because I was just working all the damn time. So you can say there's workaholism in there. There's caffeine addiction in there. But also, so I quit that probably about March when I was 29 and my birthday was in July. And on my birthday, I quit smoking. And I used to smoke quite a lot because I really did enjoy it. But the fact that I'd quit coffee made quitting smoking way easier. Because a cup of coffee and a cigarette, the two things were just
completely... They go
completely
together, right?
If I'd tried to do it the other way around, not a chance. But yes. And I was lucky. I recognized that. And so I did something. This is probably going to sound really stupid, but I was a big drinker as well. I was like, wait, what a catch, right, ladies? I recognized that habits were really important to me psychologically. And what I needed to do if I wanted to carry on drinking but not smoke was I needed to kind of create new associations. So I went out and I watched football. This is when you could still smoke in pubs in the UK. I went and I watched football in the pub, got drunk while my willpower was still strong, while I was still that sort of zealous, just quit, newly religious anti-smoker kind of thing. And everything that I had done before while smoking, I went and did it. So I didn't have that fear of doing it and that being a trap. Do you know what I mean? I knew I wouldn't have to avoid pubs. I knew I wouldn't have to avoid beer because I knew that I could do it without it. Mm-hmm. Also, during this time, when I quit smoking, I then took up running. And that is 100% replacing one addiction with another. And,
but a healthier alternative.
Yeah.
Kind of. But it's, you know, it's not addressing any root causes as to why I had these multiple addictions running side by side. I managed to do many marathons, half marathons, lead running groups. I have a UK athletics qualification. I was running at least 6 days a week. I was doing quite a few miles. I managed to do all of that while drinking very heavily. And I ended up with gout. Go me. So honestly, I am quite a catch. So if either of you know any single ladies, no, I'm just kidding. And if my girlfriend's listening, I'm joking. But no, I just wanted to chip in because I identify with basically everything you just said. I've lived. We're good. I do have a question though. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
And I know we're bouncing around a bit with this. So I'm sorry for my question. You know, like you said earlier, and I also said earlier that gambling addiction is frequently a comorbidity. But it's not always a comorbidity. Is there a difference in treatment for gambling addiction when it's a comorbidity to when it's not a comorbidity? Or is it fundamentally the same?
I would say they're different. Unfortunately, I do think in most, and this is where there's still a gap between addictions and mental health treatment, people see them siloed, right? So you have this mental health system here that say we don't treat addictions, right? You have to go somewhere else for that. And you have the addiction side here that says we don't treat the mental health. We don't do that here. So you got to go to the other side and people get dropped in the gap, right? But if they're functionally connected, then they're not always. You can't do that. They need to kind of come together. So clinically, let's say I'm seeing someone that has a gambling problem, right? But I do a careful assessment. There is no underlying mental health problem. It's not a function of mental distress, right? There's something else, and it's just, say, gambling that stands alone. Would my treatment there differ than if there is someone that has this mental health problem? I would say yes. So in this one sense, I would, I would focus more on sort of stimulus control, right? So I want to understand the triggers to the gambling. When are they gambling? You know, what's kind of driving that behavior? I would probably use things like limit setting, self-exclusion. Let's look at finances. Is there someone you can trust to kind of manage the finances? Or is there anything that we can do to block your access to gambling or set limits and help you stick to that limit? Right. So be very focused on sort of that gambling aspect, right? Sort of that behavior. What can we replace the gambling with? So with addictions, I mean, think about how much time people who are experiencing problems with gambling or alcohol, how much time they spend drinking, how much time they spend gambling, how much time they spend recovering from drinking, recovering from gambling. We have to fill that space somehow, right? It's much easier to have a, to say, instead of gambling, do this, then say, don't gamble. Then you're like, what else am I supposed to do for 6 hours? Do you want me to just sit here and be alone in my thoughts and be bored and figure out I'm not gambling? Or is there something else that we can replace that activity with that might be more quote unquote healthy? And yeah, for some, that health replaced activity could potentially become problematic. But again, what are the negative consequences to running, or what's the likelihood that you're going to experience negative consequences from exercising and running compared to what's the likelihood of experiencing negative consequences from alcohol if you do it the same amount, right? So you have some behaviors that are more likely to lead to benefits, less likely to consequences than others. So there's that aspect of it. And so someone that has gambling, I'd focus more on that. If then they say have come with gambling and depression and they're functionally linked, right? If gambling is being driven primarily by a way to escape with a depression, to help manage the depression, what do you think is going to happen if I just focus on the gambling without addressing sort of the mental health? Right. Yes, sure. I might help them reduce their gambling, but they might look somewhere else to kind of help with that. So I would then focus on the depression at the same time. I would help them manage not only the gambling, right? You do need to address that. If they're coming and they say, I have a problem with gambling and they also have depression, I target both at the same time. What I think happens most often than not is that even when they have present with both depression and gambling, people are just addressing the gambling and not the depression. So we do need to integrate and address them at the same time. So my approach would change.
I've got a question now that you might both really hate me for asking.
Go for it.
But I'm going to ask it anyway.
We know you are.
A friend of mine used to say that you can throw as much money as you want at social ills, and you'll get absolutely nowhere until you start with tackling poverty. Now, as somebody who has studied extensively the loaves of comorbidity, and this ties in with what you were saying earlier, Michael, about the reasons for gambling, and I have pissed and moaned about this because I wrote an article for IGB about one of the main problems in the RG space is that there are too many middle class voices and not enough working class voices. There are not enough people in there that have experienced waking up without hope, who've experienced crushing poverty and with no means whatsoever to escape it. And I do think, and look, I've been homeless. I've been hungry enough to eat out of bins. You know what I mean? Like, I know that shit. I know that shit personally, and it's not even as fun as it looks. Which is like, that is saying something. What role do you think poverty plays in what we've been talking about? Is it a factor? Because my gut tells me it's not just a factor, it's a significant factor.
Yeah, 1000%. So I think, and this comes also to, there's still this stigma related to addictions, right? That it's a moral failure, that it's lack of willpower. And I think that's BS. I think no one chooses to become addicted. I've never worked with an individual when I say, what brings you here? Said, I wanted to become addicted, here I am. That it doesn't happen. It's multifaceted, it's complex. And one factor for those that this is applicable to is that, and there's a term called social determinants of health that talk about how things like poverty, housing insecurity, experiencing homelessness has such detrimental impacts on our well-being and mental health, right? I practice CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, where we all talk about our perceptions and how we interpret events and trying to change our thinking to be more realistic or adaptive. And, you know, we say you can't CBT poverty away, right? If there's social determinants of health in play, you need to address that first. And so one of the things that always kind of irks me is in terms of addictions, again, for some people that are experiencing homelessness, substances is survival. It's just flat out survival, right? It's a way that sometimes they need to stay awake, right? Because it's kind of dangerous out there. Sometimes it's the only thing that just lets them forget for 3 hours the situation that they're in, right? There's a function driving that. And so I've seen some programs where they'll take people who are experiencing homelessness and also experiencing substance use issues, bring them to a residential facility, like a 3-month treatment program, 1-month treatment program. And then in that situation, what do they have? They have housing. They have a roof over their heads. They have meals, right? So they're being fed, they're getting nutrition, and then their substances decrease. And then you put them back out on the street. What's going to happen? They're going to go right back to using it, right? So I think when people are experiencing poverty, right, if they're hungry, if they don't have a roof over their heads, right, they're worried about paying their bills, you really need to, I think, address that, especially if that's a huge trigger and reason for the substance. Like, I can't psychologically will that away. I do think that has a huge role to play. And I think for a lot of people, you meet their basic needs of survival, give them a safe place to live, give them enough food to eat, right? A purpose, potentially employment. And I think in a lot of those cases, you'll see the addiction recover. I think that is extremely powerful.
Sorry, Michael.
I mean, that ties in very well with the monetary aspect that I mentioned before. Because, I mean, in the gambling industry, we picture the gambler out there as, you know, I would say more like the above average person, right? You know, if you look at the marketing campaigns, whatever, I mean, how is the gambler, the potential customer depicted? Not as the hobo out there, you know what I mean? And in reality, if you speak, I mean, I had the opportunity at a couple of events lately with former addicts, and they mentioned actually very small sums that they spent, but still that was everything they had. And these small sums wouldn't even recognize with a typical gambling operator's monitoring, you know what I mean? Like, if you look at the typical gambling operators monitoring and also regulation, it all focuses on the extreme spenders. Mm-hmm. These extreme spenders spend so much, you know. And I mean, you know, the what's it called, the prevalence paradox, right? were actually
prevention paradox,
which actually says that the majority of the harm is actually created by the large group of players who are sort of, you know, spending more or less on the bottom. And I think that absolutely to be true, but there is no evidence so far out there. But that would be very interesting to research, because that could completely flip the entire approach, right? Why do we focus on those who are losing $100,000 a month, or $10,000, or $5,000? What about all of those hundreds of thousands who are losing $50, $100, $200, $300? For some of them, that's enough, you know, to be ruinous. And they might be a problem, or they are problem gamblers, although they don't recognize on any of the reports, because their spending is so little, so low. And if you look at those few, I mean, North American regulations which have introduced mandatory reporting, they mention, investigate a player who has lost $100,000 the last month, which is, you know, a lot. Whereas in Europe, we are meantime, you know, looking at spendings of whatever, $500, $1,000 to be sort of, you know, alerting. And again, you know, I'm not saying one is better than the other. I think both don't make sense, other than, you know, if you don't look at the underlying behavior as such, you know, because somebody can behave impulsively, show indications of problem gambling, no matter whether they're spending $100,000 or $500,000.
Yeah, and that's why the low-risk gambling guidelines takes into account your household income, right? Because for someone that makes $30,000 a year...
If we knew. I mean, if you knew.
Yeah, if we knew.
Right, you know?
Yeah. Gambling $500 is a lot.
Yeah.
Someone that makes $600,000 a year, gambling $500 probably is not going to make a dent.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly,
and so in terms of the social determinants of health... again, we've done some studies asking people about their reasons why they may have experienced a gambling addiction. And one of the things that did come up that was unique to gambling, say compared to alcohol or cannabis, was this aspect of social determinants of health, and that they needed money to cover rent. They needed to buy groceries. And, you know, what gambling... in our society is probably one of the only legal ways that you could potentially win some money fairly quickly. Unfortunately, if you're going to gamble, you're most likely going to lose, right? Like, casinos aren't built on the backs of winners. They're built on backs of losers. And so, but yeah, like if you're really desperate, you're really, really desperate, and you need $300 to pay rent, and you got $50,
you might try.
Yeah, gambling might be the thing. You're like, you know what? This is, I need to go. I need this money now. Maybe I can get on a hot streak and I can win $250. But then what if you lose the 50? And then you're like, oh, now you're getting into this really desperate phase where you're trying to recoup that $50 and you just dig yourself more into a hole. But sometimes, yeah, you could win the $300. You're like, oh, this, man, I covered this
motivation that you're just mentioning, you know, I want to win, I need to win. Did you experience here any differences with respect to game type? Let's say sports betting versus, you know, casino gambling. Do you see any difference there among your clients, like the ones who really sort of have a strategic approach and really believe or misbelieve that they can, you know, get rich winning money? Would they rather sort of try their luck with sports, and the others who are escaping play the slots?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't really have an answer to that, but I think it depends on the demographic profile. Sports betting, in terms of how much it's exploded in North America, is relatively new. And I'm going to say for the younger demographic, young men that need money, I can imagine them, they're using sports betting.
Yeah, we know
for
that's,
some,
that's confirmed by studies.
Yeah,
prevalence for, studies.
Mm. Yeah, for some, it might, they might go to the roulettes. They might go to slot machines. So I think it really depends on their familiarity, their preferred form of gambling, and what they think they're going to have the best shot of making that money.
In your clinical practice, how significant is the online gambling? Because you live in Toronto, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Toronto is in Ontario, and in Ontario there are online casinos. It's the only Canadian province that introduced an online gambling law, which allows private operators, apart from the lottery, to offer online casino and online sports betting.
Yeah, so give me one second. So in my clinical work right now, I don't see very many people with gambling problems. That's going to change, I think. But I do have some colleagues that have been asking me about how to work with people with gambling problems. And there has been, I've also heard from colleagues in the States as well, and in Canada, that their clients are changing. Their clients look different. It used to be middle-aged, right? Some 40, 50 individuals that predominantly play slot machines, right? EGMs, we know they're a high-risk form of gambling because of structural characteristics.
Yeah.
But now we're hearing that who is showing up in the offices tend to be younger. They tend to be young men that have gotten into problems with sports betting, right? So you're starting to see this demographic shift in who is coming into treatment, which is, I think, directly tied to what's happening in terms of legalization and liberalization of sports betting here in North America. So that is shifting a bit.
Yeah. Because of the availability, right? Because, I mean, they could...
A lot of factors.
Before offshore, but now, of course, you have more advertising because many states have, I think 31 states in the US have introduced sports betting. And in Canada, you can legally play online with...
BetMGM, Sports Interaction, I see. I'm a huge sports fan, so I see these ads all the time. And that's the other bread and butter of my research, John, is I do a lot of research on sports betting in terms of the impact of all the legislative changes that happened here in Canada, and including advertisements.
Okay, give us a short summary. Now you're teasing a subject we didn't even touch, so you gotta share something.
Okay, so what's the short summary? So in like other jurisdictions, this isn't new. But if you were to ask me who is a prototypical average sports bettor, they're young men with high education, disposable income, that are a bit impulsive and drink alcohol, right? And if you look at the sports betting advertisements, that's who they're targeting, if that's who they're geared to. And what we're finding is also that in-play betting, so being able to make bets while the game is ongoing, especially in things like the micro prop bets where it's not tied to the outcome of the game, but who's going to score the next goal. Given the structural characteristic similarities to slot machines, we're finding that is associated with greater risk of gambling problems and greater risk of harms. We're also finding that if you drink and bet on sports, that's a really risky mix. People that drink alcohol while betting on sports tend to bet more. They tend to bet more impulsively. They lose more money. They experience more harms. Again, not surprising. And we're also finding that advertisements are very common in Canada. People see them. Even in provinces where these big gambling companies are not operating at the moment. So Ontario, where I am in Toronto, is the only province that have opened up its gaming markets. And all the other provinces is the provincial operators that run the gambling. But what we're seeing is that these advertisements are creeping into the other provinces because there's national broadcast, people stream, they go on TSN, right? So they're seeing these advertisements, and it is associated with sports betting frequency. We're also seeing, I think what was really funny, it was a cross-sectional study, but we asked people if they've seen sports betting advertisements, yes. And then we asked them, has seeing that advertisements influenced your future sports betting, right? It's got I think it's a moderate correlation in terms of strength. And then we asked about responsible gambling ads, if they've seen it. And we asked them, did it help you regulate your sports betting? And they said, not really. So yeah, they're seeing sports betting advertisements and they're betting. They're seeing responsible gambling advertisements and it's not really doing much. That's because a lot of the responsible gambling ads here is very superficial.
Of course,
those bet responsibly.
Marketing ads.
Yeah, they? Marketing ads are great. They really make it exciting.
That the Archie ads are marketing ads. You know what I mean? Because that's another way actually to make great marketing. I mean, you roll out the responsible gaming.
It's brand awareness, right?
Brand awareness, exactly.
Yeah. Here's Connor McDavid, bet responsibly. What does that even mean? And then you go to their sports, and I've done this. You go to the operator's website, and Connor McDavid or the big superstars, nowhere to be found. I have to dig and dig and dig to get to the RG stuff.
Yeah. Mm. No, I mean, in my opinion, as long, you know, as, I mean, for I just, you know, submitted a paper, and in that paper, I analyzed data from the US, like real world online gambling data, Canada and a couple of Western European countries with different regulations. And of course, in Germany, Spain, Netherlands, regulation goes as far as maximum spend limits. And in Canada, in Ontario and in the US, players do not even have to set the limit, right? I mean, they have the so the operators have to provide the option to set the limit, but they don't have to. And in some US states, the operators do not have to provide the option to set the limit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, if we talk about, you know, taking responsible gaming to some degree seriously, every player would have to set a limit at registration. I mean, no matter what's the limit, but they have to set it, you know, and you can enhance also the compliance, you know, giving them like a back, you know, some background, like, okay, you know, it should be, you know, I mean, just, you know, put the slider at your annual income and then you will get the respective limit. And this way you could sort of recognize the lower risk gambling limits, but nobody does it because regulation doesn't require it, you know?
Yeah, and if it doesn't require, why would you?
Exactly, why would you? Yeah, I'm not judgmental here or anything. It's the regulator's fault, in my opinion, because why should the operators do it if they don't have to do it? What I see is lots of cool campaigns by the large, you know, gambling operators. And like you say, those are brand awareness. Because, okay, I do a campaign about, let's say, positive play. I mean, what does it mean, you know? Like, play positively. What the fuck? I mean, you know, what's that mean? I mean, you know, I find it a cool concept and everything, but how does that relate to whatever, you know, the uneducated, sort of, you know, middle-aged coal mine worker out there? I mean, that doesn't even go through, you know? They are so intellectual, these campaigns, and they are built by people who are intellectual, right? Like, at least, you know, two of us here. And John, you too, of course.
Yeah, but, don't worry. I was just counting me and Andrew.
That's, you know, it has to be much simpler, you know, completely intuitive.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. And that's also where all of this, sorry to interrupt, all of this sort of, you know, all of this, okay, people don't use RG tools comes from, right? Because if I hide it somewhere on the website, and okay, you know, how would people even find it? Of course, you know, then you have 1 out of 1,000 sets a limit, but I can, you know, make 100% set the limit if I want to.
Yeah, and if I was an operator and I wanted to be serious about RG and show demonstrated effects, instead of spending millions of dollars in these advertisements, I would just enforce a mandatory limit.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I would do it. It's going to hurt my bottom line, yeah, but I can show solved. Effectiveness yeah. there.
It's all gone quiet.
What do you think, John?
I try not to think,
Michael.
I know it hurts.
No, but there is a lot of, no pun intended, food for thought in this conversation. And it's, well, you know what you're saying about positive play. Like, positive play is one of the smarter schemes out there. There's no two ways about that. It's considerably better than the old when the fun stops that we had here in the UK. I mean, that was just fucking bullshit. But the problem for any campaign of any kind is the same. And it's a marketing problem, right? Uh-huh. Because I believe this should be approached as a marketing task. The key for marketing is right message to the right person at the right time in the right language. Uh-huh. Right, that's a bunch of things that have got to come together. Now, as with most addictions, or as with many addictions, or as with many addicts, people are operating like they don't have a problem because they, and I'm going to stick my neck out here, like nobody ever, what's the word I'm looking for? Nobody ever intervened with me because I mostly drank on my own. So it's not like friends could see me getting shit-faced every night kind of thing. But I did that for years. Before I sort of realized, hang on a second. Maybe this isn't quite what everybody else out there is doing. But if it's getting the right message to the right people at the right time in the right way, like in the right way being using the right media and the right language to reach them, right? If that's the case, then generalized mass schemes aren't really gonna be the way forward, are they? No. You know what I mean?
And I think even just the quality and care taken to the inducements compared to RG, you'll notice a difference, at least here.
But it's really interesting because so much of the conversations that are going on in the background in the industry are about personalization, they're about CRM software, which is about granular data analysis and being able to effectively personalize and time the marketing to a gambler in just the right way. And this software is amazing. I mean, it's phenomenal. And it's taking what would have been a team of 20. Mm-hmm. Down to a much faster responding team of 2 or 3, because you can automate so many of these triggers and all of these things. Well, if we can personalize all of that, surely we can apply a bit of common sense and personalize what we're offering in RG messaging. Surely we can look at the types of games people are playing. We can look at, whether that's intervening or encouraging people to use tools. Because if you see the types of games people play, say they're playing 70% of their games have an ancient Egypt theme. Mm-hmm. Well, then your incentivization for them to set a limit should be some free spins on a game they actually play or on a type of game they actually play. You know, or it is a wild thing. And here's something that I've never heard of anybody doing, right?
Yeah, and I'll what say if... this too.
Sorry.
I'll say this to wrap up, but we're doing some of that work right now in terms of responsible gambling messages, is trying to see whether there's an effect if you tailor the RG messages based on their preferred form of gambling, even just as simple as that. Yeah. And we've done an environmental scan of RG messaging to try to see if we can use that to sort of generate custom messaging. And what was really interesting that spoke volumes is that there really isn't. So we didn't have really good source material to try and see, are there real world examples of RG messaging that are tailored to preference of game type? And there isn't. But even just as simple as that, right? So are RG strategies and who plays, say, slot machines, is that going to be as effective for someone that bets on sports? Right, you have different demographic profiles, motivational aspects, and different structural characteristics. And so that's some of the work that we're doing now. And
that's potentially really interesting because, like you say, gambling so often comes under a huge umbrella when, in fact, there is the only commonality is the stake. Mm-hmm. And there's very little between, you know, a slot player, a sports bettor, etc. So there might be some that there is likely to be some overlap, but that overlap might only be the location.
Yep,
could be a totally different. But I was thinking about the incentivizing people to. This might be bonkers. I don't think it is. I think this might be. It's either bonkers or genius. I don't think there's any middle ground. Right. I was thinking that in the sign up process, say for an online gambling thing, and it could be any online gambling thing, you put I hate this expression, but I use any, you put a gamified element in there, right? And you use that gamified element, and this comes from something you said to me ages ago, Dr. Auer. You said about how problematic gamblers will begin with problematic behaviors as soon as they sign up and start betting.
Yeah, sure.
It doesn't take a month to figure it out. It takes like 5 minutes. Yeah. And I was thinking, if you gamify a part of the startup process, which gets them incentivized with, say, it's free spins or whatever, to use the tools in the right way, right? But if you gamify part of that, A, yes, you've got to give them something that's worth not losing to do this, right? But you can use the results of that to surely begin building that player's profile because you're going to see what kind of risk taker they are according to how they gamble. So say you've got different tiers that they can win and how they respond to using those different tiers, you could actually potentially get a reasonable amount of information about their risk profile before they've even placed a bet. And you could use that to influence what games they see.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that comes back to what, you know, I learned long time in psychology about the objective tests, you know, can I sort of subtly through gimmick, you know, questions, etc., find out, you know, about the person's sort of motivation, not asking them directly, because that's the issue, right? You know, you ask them, and I mean, Andrew, you can confirm that often, you know, the self-report studies came up with completely different results than the real-world studies, because you have them play in a lab like you did, you know, in Carleton University, and they stop. They are compliant, but in reality, they don't stop because they have spent their money, they have spent lots of money, they have been gambling for hours. So I think if, you know, somebody managed to come up with, let's call it a test, which reliably predicts somebody's, you know, risk affinity, that would be awesome.
Well, I don't need a royalty for it if anybody wants to use it. But if you want to give me one, that's also fine.
Yeah, we'll talk about this after. But thank you, Andrew, for joining us.
Yes, thank you very,
pleasure.
Very much.
My pleasure.
And we didn't touch subjects like loot boxes, gaming addiction, difference between gaming and gambling. And that's also part of your research, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
We're gonna do
maybe next time.
Next time.
Yeah, would you mind coming back on?
No, of course.
Are you sure?
Like I said, I can
make it so that Michael's away. If that's any help.
Are you gonna be in Vegas in May?
No, I'll, I have too many conferences and I have to pick and choose. So okay. That's the one I'm going to unfortunately miss out on.
Oh, Michael, it's just a coincidence that he's chosen not to be at the one that we'll both be at.
Oh, you'll both be at Vegas. No, I'll be at Agri in Banff.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And then ICBA in Istanbul.
Oh, wow. Okay. Ogi, the Behavioral Addictions Conference.
Yeah.
Nice.
We're doing the podcast from the Vegas conference.
Oh, nice.
We'll be recording it.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe I'll show up. We'll see.
If you need an incentive, there's one. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrew.
My pleasure.
This episode of Addiction and Hour with Hour is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit gaminglabs.com.